What you're about to hear is a segment from the Mark Steiner Show archives. Send your thoughts about this show to talk@steinershow.org or tweet me at Mark Steiner. Enjoy. So this hour, we are going to take a look at the question that this society has been wrestling with for many, 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 many decades, perhaps since the beginning and founding of this country, which is the question of guns. We are part of a society that in many ways was founded on guns and violence, the guns and violence that allowed this country to grow by wiping out the indigenous people who lived here, or trying to wipe out the indigenous people who live here, taking the lands to expand by the violence of the enslavement of African people in this country that killed tens of millions and enslaved millions in this country. And under the gun. Many of us look at the Second Amendment, which many people cherish, which is the right to bear arms, and there's a battle over what does that mean, the right to bear arms in America. Some, if you look at some of the original documents of the development of the U.S. Constitution, some of that debate was very interesting, as I was reading some months back, some years back. A lot of those arguments being made for that Second Amendment were made by Southern states, because they needed their Southern militias to ensure that slavery was intact, that they had the right to go after people who ran for their freedom, the right to keep people in check in slavery. That's a big part of the birth of that amendment. And I think there's no mistake as to why many of the people who advocate for gun rights in the strongest sense are also people that come out of the Confederacy and out of the people from the Confederacy who settled the American West. All those things are connected. They're not disconnected. So there's also a question, as many of us who were in the civil rights movement, and as one of our guest books has talked about, that during the civil rights movement, nonviolence was a tactic to keep things going and pushing the end of segregation and racial terror in the South. But as many of us learned, some of the folks who lived in the communities that were being organized were always guns, the guns that protected us from them when they came to get us. So that is also part of this legacy. Many people look at what happened in our country now and see that what happened in Aurora and Newtown and Charleston as being because of the proliferation of guns, because of the madness and insanity of individual human beings, but they're also tied to a larger social construct, both in terms of guns, our ability to have guns, but also because of racism in the society, especially when it comes to things like Charleston and the numbers of black people in this country who've been killed by guns, toted by whites who wanted to keep people down. And also we've seen the surge of violence in this country consuming people at the poorest communities in America. So it's a complex question. Add to that the gun industry, a multi-billion-dollar industry that makes a lot of money on the sale of guns in this country, and the $4.4 billion they make on just sales overseas, almost $5 billion. So we're going to tackle what all that means with our three guests. We are joined here today in studio by Dr. Furman DeBrabander. Did I say that right?
DeBrabander.
DeBrabander. I'm sorry, Furman. I should know that all these years knowing you. DeBrabander, professor of philosophy at the Maryland Institute of College of Art, author of Do Guns Make Us Free, Democracy, and the Armed Society. Charlie Cobb Jr. joins us once again, author of This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible, former secretary, field secretary for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and a senior analyst at allafrica.com. Charlie, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be back again.
And Dante Berry joins us. And Dante Berry is a grassroots and online organizer, executive director of Million Hoodies March for Justice, and wrote an article for The Nation magazine called Guns and the New Civil Rights Movement, Charleston is Not Sandy Hook. And Dante, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org and join us. Comment on our Facebook pages or send us or tweet us at Mark Steiner. But do call 410-319-8888. So this question of guns in America, Charlie Cobb, may I start with you?
Sure.
Is a complex question, as I was trying to lay out at the top. And we want to kind of always kind of take these linear arguments about what it means, gun control, no gun control, but all the things around that, we don't kind of talk about what fuels that, which is the real power of this argument, I think.
Yes and no. Look, I often find myself the odd man out in these kinds of discussions about guns. What you said in the introduction is true. Guns were used to found the country, the seizure of Native American lands, the so-called westward expansion, which is the conquest of Native Americans, slavery, and the use of guns and force and violence and all of that. But, and I should preface this by saying, I'm a believer in the right to possess a weapon if you want one. But guns were also important to the resistance against white supremacy and white privilege. That certainly was our experience in the South in the 1960s. I feel that in some respects, the whole discussion about guns is not distorted, isn't the word I want, but confused. You know, you can't, there are what, 30 million guns in private hands, I think, something like that. But there are 30,000 deaths through use of guns. And that's a horrible number, but a tiny minority of the 30 million guns, especially when you consider that half of those 30,000 deaths from guns are suicides, which suggest more a mental health problem than a gun problem. I'm for a coherent discussion about guns and gun possession. I don't feel that just because there's death because of gun violence, say, as took place in Charleston, South Carolina, not so long ago, that should introduce a discussion about the legitimacy or illegitimacy of guns. It is, to borrow your words in asking me to speak, a complex question. But complex questions can be addressed coherently, in my view.
And I want to get back to that, the idea of how we address this, what seems like a complex question, coherently, which I think is an important point to make. And let me turn it down to Furman. I mean, De Brabander. I mean, you wrote the book "Do Guns Make Us Free: Democracy and the Armed Society." Your take is similar, but a little bit different than Charlie Cobb's.
Well, I also am not against the right to bear arms. I think that we've been entirely too unregulated in allowing that right. And by the way, there are somewhere between 270 million and 300 million privately owned firearms in this country. So that's almost one per citizen. There is no country on earth that even comes close to us. I think Yemen is number two. They have somewhere around 60 per 100 residents. In America, we have close to 90 privately owned firearms per 100 residents. We are a country awash in firearms and in loose regulations. And the problem is that the gun rights movement has been on a tremendous offensive in the last decade or so in getting its way, in loosening regulations. There is, of course, the loophole for private background checks. The ATF has been utterly hobbled by the NRA's efforts in Congress. And, of course, we have open carry laws. We have campus carry on college campuses. We have guns in our schools now. That was our chosen response to Sandy Hook, was to place armed guards and, in some cases, armed teachers in our schools. So the problem is not guns per se. It is the way we refuse, or at least the NRA has been successful in getting us to refuse any kind of regulation at all whatsoever, even though somewhere upwards of 80% of Americans supposedly favor some things such as private background checks for firearm sales.
And Dante, let me, did you pick up that thread, if you would?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think that, as you mentioned, I wrote a piece for The Nation about the recent movement for Black Lives and guns, right? And what we saw from the response in Charleston was an immediate thrown response to putting more stronger gun regulations, which will add to criminalization of Black people, which provides more surveillance, more policing, more incarceration. And then you also saw responses like, oh, Dylann Roof is not a racist or a white supremacist, but he's instead someone that needs to be dealt with in terms of his mental health issue. And the question I always ask is, like, is racism a mental health issue? I don't necessarily think so. But I think what was mentioned is something goes to this fundamental question, who gets the right to feel safe in this country, right? And when we think about the idea of safety, this is in relationship to the power dynamics that Black people do not have in terms of the power that Black people have in relationship to those that feel actually safe and more comfortable in their own existence. So this is fundamentally about an issue about power, and this is fundamentally an issue about who has the right to feel safe. And ultimately, Black people don't feel safe with police. Black people don't feel safe with white supremacist vigilantes. And Black people don't feel safe in, within their own communities, right? So when we think about how do we reduce gun violence, and when we think about what is this whole ultimate issue, we need more strong, powerful, organized communities and actually a reinvestment in Black communities in particular, because they haven't largely been disinvested in.
So let me pick up on this last point Dante made. And Charlie, one of the things you said when your first statement was, I think if I heard you correctly, I am a believer in the right to own with guns. I wouldn't disagree with that either. And to be very frank, I've said on the air before, I am a gun owner. I'm not going to, so I wouldn't, you know, it'd be ludicrous for me to say otherwise. But the issue here is thinking what Dante just said, in terms of the reality that the Black community does not feel safe, in part because of the proliferation of guns in crumbling communities, because of the police, because of the right wing having a lot of guns. And that is part of the push to own guns and have guns be more readily available. It's also a political question for people on the right who say everything is a government conspiracy and Black and brown people as the problem. So that's what, when I say the kind of complexity, the contradiction, it lays there. So how do we respond to it in that when that's part of the reality?
See, I think this issue, and I think it's truth. You know, the question of safety in Black communities, particularly inner city Black communities, that 25% of the Black community that remains trapped at the bottom, which is where you see most of the gun violence. And even that is done by a small minority of people. Usually, it's usually gang violence or retaliatory violence and the like. I think the question of safety, the question of empowerment, is not a gun question. That's the organizing question.
Uh-huh.
How do you do that, particularly in inner city? My primary concern is with Black community. I live in an inner city Black community in Jacksonville, Florida, and most of my neighborhood is armed, but there are no gangs here, and I don't worry about them having pistols. See, I see these questions as not, that's what I mean when I say it's not very coherent. I see these questions as not centering on guns, but centering on issues like empowerment, centering on, like, on issues of community control. How, particularly in the most violence-racked communities, do you organize? What's the language that you can find to speak to young people in particular who use guns in crazy kinds of ways or in vicious ways because it's tied into money and drug trafficking and retaliation as a whole culture? But that's not most of the Black community, not even most of the poor Black community. I think the way the gun discussion is framed takes away from that discussion, which is very, very necessary.
So that's so. And in some ways, this is part. Fermi, let me just jump in here with your thoughts before we go back to Dante and the phones of 410-319-8888. And Clarence, you're the first caller up. We're going to come to your call, so please all join us in here, 410-319-8888. I read giant chunks of your book. I've not finished reading it. Looking forward to finishing it so I can get you back on the show just to talk about the book. But this is part of the question here, that there are those who think the problem in our society is guns, and I have a poet in town, David Eberhardt, who I know will corner me when this is over, saying that is the problem, and you should be saying that's the problem, Mark. The issue is guns, and that's what perpetuates violence. So they're saying, no, the right and many people who are on the left and in Black and brown communities say, no, it's not the guns, it's the nature of society that's causing our problems.
Right. Well, I will take something that Charlie just said, a very interesting statement. This is, I scribbled on the quote, the question of safety is not a gun question. I agree in this sense. Safety and peace in society is upheld by rule of law. It's not ensured by guns. And that I understand, and to the extent that he's speaking about African-American communities that are mired in violence and gang violence in particular, I totally agree. We need to figure out ways to ensure that those communities have rule of law and that they are protected and safe in ways that they feel they're safe as well from the police. But it's not the guns of the individual gun owners that is going to make those neighborhoods safe either. So his, I take Charlie's quote is cutting two ways, especially as related to his neighborhood in Jacksonville. I would also say this, that profusion of guns in society, it does endanger safety. There are numerous studies done by our colleagues down here at the Bloomberg Center at Hopkins that point out that a gun in the home is a indicator of a higher prevalence of domestic violence that ends in death. And, you know, a gun in the home leads to higher incidents of, you know, children getting their hands on those guns. There was a very big article done in the New York Times a few months ago about the number of children that die at the hands of guns in the home. So I do not, and of course I would point to the Stand Your Ground laws and the kinds of, you know, incidences and how they escalate matters. So I agree, peace is not brought about by the gun, but quite frankly, peace is endangered by the gun, and our society is a testament to that. No one in the developed world comes even close to our level of gun violent deaths.
So let me go, who's this, Dante? Go ahead.
I think, you know, the gun culture in the United States is unique. There's no similarity in any other part of the world, at least that I've been to, and I've traveled widely, that reflects anything close to the kind of gun culture that exists in the United States. And I'm not going to pursue that discussion. I would like to say one thing about children and young people being killed by guns. I mean, more, and I don't have the numbers handy off the top of my head, more kids, more young people are killed by stray bullets and retaliatory bullets than they are by unsecured guns in a home. And the typical neighbor in my neighborhood will tell you how he or she, either himself or herself, or knows someone who used a gun to chase somebody out of the house that was threatening them.
That's an excellent question. I'd like to know that as well. I'm going to ask my colleagues at the Bloomberg and find out. That's a good point. I have not seen any statistics or data bearing that out, but that's a very good point to pursue.
And we have, let me bring Dante back in. Dante, I mean, you've been listening to this, and, you know, the question is it guns or society? And when you look at things like open carry that Furman was talking about earlier and Stand Your Ground, these were laws built around the right to carry a weapon. And really what the subtext is the right for white people to carry weapons to defend themselves against black people and anybody else they don't like through the South and the West.
Yes, fundamentally. So I think when you, like an example of that is that like right after Charleston, Chuck Todd on Meet the Press used Charleston as an opportunity to actually perpetuate a image of black communities driven by gun violence, that black people must be controlled, right? There is a segment that he ran a video montage of all these black folks that were impacted by gun violence and also ended up being incarcerated because of it. Not a single person in that montage was a white person. And so when we look at
right.
also,
when I we remember also, that, right.
But when we also look at the responses to these mass shootings, right? These mass shootings, the majority of the time, the mass shootings that happen are perpetuated by young white men. And those responses have led to where oh, maybe this person has a mental health issue or he was always so innocent. And the criminalization, a way that they demonize communities of color, is very differently, and we're more likely to consider that an incident of terrorism than we are of Charleston, or even, for instance, the incident that happened in Santa Barbara, where it was an incident of misogyny, the shooter was a young white man and shot all white different communities of women, but we didn't call that an incident of terrorism, right? So there is a fundamental power dynamic, and also there is a biased view when we think about who has the right to own guns, and then also who has the right to be safe in this country, right? And I think going back to Charlie's point, this is fundamentally about not necessarily about the issue of guns itself, but I think it's more so about how communities are organized and how communities have power over other type of communities. And to my point in my article, that this was the incident in Charleston was particularly not, like, people were afraid to call it an incident of white supremacy or an incident of racist terror, but immediately went to talking about gun control and gun regulations. And it became an immediate political moment for people to really say, all right, we really need to pass these background check laws and things like that. When we actually look at how gun laws are impacting
Right. Communities
of color, those are actually regressive policies. If folks are really more progressive in terms of ending mass criminalization or mass incarceration, because ultimately it's just about locking more criminals up and not necessarily about how do we actually end mass criminalization. When we see this movement around Black Lives, this is ultimately a movement around ending mass criminalization.
Very quick, we have tons of callers. We've got to get to them.
But I wanted to make one comment to what Dante just said. Dante, I would say that, the abundance of guns in the society, you have misogyny, you have racism, of course, but in a free speech society such as ours, you're allowed to have those views and hold them. But this proliferation of guns and gun-friendly laws and lack of background checks, this makes our conversations explosive and violent and dangerous. In other developed nations, they are allowed to have these conversations. They don't have guns in the mix. I agree with you. Guns are not central to the problem, but let's take them out.
So I do want to kind of wrestle with the three of you. The question is, do we need gun control in the United States of America? Do you need the background checks? Do we need to limit the access to guns in our country? That's part of the bottom line of the question. One of the questions.
Common sense would tell you. There are certain common sense rules for regulating guns that I think are legitimate. Background checks, and that sort of thing. I mean, I would be opposed. I think you should leave your guns at home if you're going to the bar.
Right.
I
agree.
I think there's certain common sense ways to regulate here, and those common sense ways run into the kind of right-wing opposition of this sort of hysterical paranoia about the federal government is getting ready to seize my weapons so that they can enslave me or something like that. Look, I want to just make one point that should also be part of the discussion about guns and particularly black and minority community. That's the class question. What we're talking about in terms of violence, excepting for police violence, which cuts through class, it seems to me, that when you really talk about violence and who suffers from gun violence, you're talking about the poorest of the poor in black communities. And part of the problem, in my view, and this may be a whole nother show, is a failure of black leadership.
That's a powerful point to end on for just a quick break. And we have to come back come right back. And Clarence, Hank, Ray, Nick, Max, five callers holding on. We're going to get right to your calls as we come back from this news break. Stay with us as we talk with Furman de Brabander, Charlie Cobb Jr., Dante Berry about guns in our society and the way we do not talk about them. And we're trying to talk about them here on the Mark Steiner Show. Stay with us. We will be right back from this break as we go to break. So much in love by the Times. George Williams of the Times died on this day in 2004. We'll be right back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to an archived edition of The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. So we're not accepting calls, but please send us your feedback at steinershow@gmail.com. Now back to our segment. Welcome back. Bebopaluba, Gene Vincent. And this day in 1956, Gene Vincent made his television debut when he performed the song on the Perry Como Show. We'll have a quiz after the show, see who knows even who Perry Como was. So we are here with Dr. Furman de Brabander, who's professor of philosophy at the Maryland Institute College of Art. off of the book Do Guns Make Us Free? Democracy and the Armed Society. Charlie Cobb Jr., who wrote the book This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible, a former field secretary for SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, back in the 1960s, and a senior analyst at AllAfrica.com. Dante Barry is executive director of the Million Hoodies March for Justice, who wrote the article in The Nation magazine called Guns and the New Civil Rights Movement, Charleston is Not Sandy Hook. And you at 410-319-8888. And as I promised, going to go right to the phones. Clarence, you've been holding on the longest. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Right. With respect to you and your guests, I could get an inference that there's a suggestion that the problem with violence and gun violence overall in America is a problem that originates in the black community because of the violence there and the drug violence and on its way up. Well, those types of problems existed when prohibition was in America also. So you cannot take that equation and start with the black community and work your way up to a larger problem. That problem is a top-down problem where we all have a boogeyman that we need to protect ourselves from in this country. You know, I need a gun because I need to protect myself from Mark Steiner because he's the white guy. So on and so on. So don't, you cannot start this conversation from, and break it down like, you know, the black community is the lowest common denominator and we're going to work our way up through that equation till we find a problem. No, that's a top-down problem. Thanks, Mr. Steiner.
And from another point of view, Edward tweeted in, the problem is the war on drugs. Any of the war on drugs will substantially reduce gun violence. Guns are a deterrent. Guns allow law-abiding citizens to protect themselves from being a victim of crimes. Guns were also a check on the balance of power of government to protect citizens from tyranny and despotism. Two very different viewpoints before we turn to our next caller. Very quick comments from my guest. What do you think about what he just said, Charlie?
Well, I think the person makes the point connecting, you know, drugs and gun violence made a very valid point. I mean, you know, if you look at black history, there's always been armed resistance to various forms of oppression, and drug trafficking is the latest form of that. There's always been reluctance. It's a complicated story. I mean, you know, if you look at groups like the Deacons for Defense and Justice in Louisiana or some of the groups in Mississippi, I mean, while they were willing to use arms against the Ku Klux Klan, they were slower when it came to police violence. And there are practical reasons for that, it seems to me. I think, you know, to say that there's a problem with gun violence in poor inner-city black communities is not to, one, blame the black community for that violence, and B, is not to say in tackling that particular problem, you're ignoring the larger problem of how gun culture functions in this country.
Right. I think that's part, if I go back to the phones here, but that's, I mean, that, I think what Charlie said is part of the issue here, the part of it.
What's that? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. What just Charlie saying in response to where where you are with guns in a society? You were saying earlier before we went to break about open carry and stand your ground. The issue here is that this is not what you said going to break. Let me go to the phones here. I'm sorry to be confusing. It was my fault. I was confused that, and I apologize to all my guests.
Can I speak to the person who tweeted in?
Sure.
I mean, guns are not a deterrent. The open carry is not a deterrent. That just indicates the kind of weapon you have on you and what it would take for our violent criminals to take you on. Do you really believe that the armed gangs in Baltimore City are deterred, or criminals anywhere are deterred by armed citizens? Criminals in this country have access to the same semi-automatic weapons as anyone else. I don't believe it's a deterrent. And I would also say that guns provide no deterrence against tyranny. We have the most sophisticated military on earth this government has at its disposal. There is no reason to believe that unaffiliated individual armed citizens can pose a credible threat to that system.
Travis tweets in, if it's the nature of our society, then the last thing we need is access to guns. 410-319-8888. Hank, you're on the air. Line one.
How are you doing today?
Very well, Hank.
Mr. Steiner, now, I do believe I'd rather be caught with it than without it, right, to protect myself. But understanding this, right, didn't they do a study or had some kind of scientific done where it read your fingerprint and your heartbeat significant to yourself? Right? And if not, right, with all of this modern technology that we have today, why wouldn't they start applying that to guns? Right? It would seem as though they would want to put the Band-Aid on it instead of just, you know, completely fixing the whole wound. That was just my thought.
Hang on, so it's an interesting thought. And Dante, let's jump in here. I mean, I think that this is, I mean, do we not have to deal with the proliferation of guns in our society, or do we?
I think we do, and I agree with Charlie's comments about that there are some common sense methods and practices that we can push forward. But I think what is the challenge is finding what does common sense mean. Common sense is relative to specific communities, as is the commonality of identifying what safety means, right? For some, safety can mean not getting mugged on the side of the street. And then for some, safety means is like being able to protect yourself in different ways, right? So I think we need to come first with a perspective that for all types of communities have a different version, a different identification of what it means to be safe. But we need to have a values-driven conversation about what does that mean and how do we work towards a vision for that. And I do think that when we get to that perspective, we need to identify what type of communities are more likely to feel unsafe. And within most communities, those communities that are actually more succumb to violence are actually Black trans women, transgendered women. Who are killed almost every single day,
right,
by police, by individual people, by whatever. So we need to center our conversations by who are more likely to feel less unsafe, and then start into getting conversations about, all right, what are the policy perspectives that we need to do? Because ultimately, that's a very top-down type of perspective of saying that we need to create these types of things. When more likely than not, some of these policies are actually working against the communities that we're trying to keep safe in the first place.
So let me go back to the phone very quick.
Very quick to that, to the question that the caller just asked. I believe he was asking about the technology and whether that can help us reduce gun violence, and it can. There is smart gun technology, but the NRA has blocked it.
410-319-8888. Let us go to Ray in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Couple quick points. Just to agree with one of your guests, guns are not a deterrent. I mean, the data on that is overwhelming, and that really, I don't even know why we debate that anymore. Couple of the guests had mentioned that they don't know of any other nation that is dangerous as us when it comes to guns. Well, there is another nation that's very comparable, and it's South Africa. And the correlation between America and South Africa is evident. There is the racial strife, especially considering the browning of America, the Donald Trump's promoting nativism, and which, again, put him on top, shows that many white Americans, the paranoia is at an all-time high. The guns escalated again when Obama was installed for the first and second time. And the correlation between racism and guns in America and Africa are extremely high. And one final point.
Sure.
When we look at nations like Germany, and I've mentioned this to you before, Mark, 2011, you can look this up, Google it. The entire police force shot 85 bullets the entire year. Half of those shots were warning shots. In nations where people have something called jobs, health insurance, quality education, gun violence doesn't even exist. So we act like this is 10 times more complex than what it is. We are in an economic – this capitalism that we have is not a capitalism. It's a hyper-Darwinian a survival scheme that many people are failing on, and as they fail, the gun empowers them, and it makes them think that the Hispanics or the blacks or the browns aren't going to come and get them. Much of this could be solved simply through economics. I don't see it happening, but we will be looked at upon 100 years from now as barbarians. Thank you.
Right, and to me, in some ways, Charlie Cobb, I think you gave us a definition of capitalism by itself. That is what it is. But, Charlie, would you respond to that first, please?
Look, there's no question. The United States, as I said, is unique in terms of how guns function in its culture. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I make a separation in my mind. If you want to talk about attacking the social ills and social injustices in this country, particularly as they pertain to black people, my primary concern, then that's not a gun discussion. You know, I see the problem of gun violence in very specific terms. There is the gun violence of police that has to do with police culture and what they think they can get away with. There is the gun violence associated in poor communities where gangs and drug trafficking runs rampant. That's a question that, to address, in my view, has to be addressed at two levels in terms of what kind of services society is going to offer to the poorest of the poor and what kind of organizing work, and I stress organizing work, is going to unfold in these communities. If you could do these two things, that would go a long way. If you could figure out how to speak to the people who engage in acts of violence in inner city neighborhoods, and nobody has figured that out, to my way of thinking, you'd go a long way towards solving the gun problem, which is not a problem of gun possession. It's maybe a problem of some people who possess guns, but in general of the, and I did misspeak. I meant to say 300 million, not 30 million. But in terms of the 300 million people who possess guns right now, that's not where the problem is centered. The problem is centered, as this, the last person who called in pointed out, this system that keeps poor people poor, that provides welfare for the rich, that enables police violence, is the problem. And that, to me, raises the organizing question.
Mm-hmm.
That's absolutely right. I want to jump in real quick. I think that's absolutely right.
Go ahead, Dante. Then I'm going to go right back to the phones and come right back to Furman. Go ahead.
I think that when you also see the number one country with level of gun violence is the United States. You also see the number one country of who's incarcerating folks is the United States. When we look at those numbers more in depth, who is most impacted by the level of gun violence and the level of incarceration rates? That's communities of color. And so when we think about that, right, safety looks like a move away from mass criminalization and a move towards fewer police. Safety requires a move towards community organizing and power building. And safety requires models of restorative justice instead of escalation tactics, right? And community-based solutions. And when we look at all of this, this has been a large part, a disinvestment in communities of color with economic deprivation, political isolation. And so we need a direct reinvestment into this. So this is for black communities and black poor communities in particular, this is less about an issue about guns, but more also about the connection between racism and economic deprivation.
I'm going to go to the phones here, and I actually have another question here. This is a fascinating kind of look at guns, as I was saying during the break, that we don't often hear in the air from a very different perspective. And I hope you join us here more, 410-319-8888. Let's go to Max. You're on the air.
I appreciate the opportunity to participate in the discussion. I do not have a gun. I think we live in a sick gun culture. I could point out that teddy bears are regulated more than guns. I appreciated the last caller pointing out the situation in places like Germany, London, et cetera. I have a poster that actually has the few numbers of people killed by guns in Japan, et cetera. I could list many, many examples of the madness. We had the woman at Walmart who was packing a gun, and her child pulled the gun out and killed the mother in Walmart. We had the situation where another mother was packing in the back seat with her child. The child pulled it out, shot the father in the buttocks. I have a friend that I used to work with. His brother was a police officer, and he was working a second shift, and he left the gun when he fell on the chair to fall asleep that night, and the son shot himself, had to be helicoptered to Hopkins Hospital. We have a problem. We have suicides. We have mentally ill people getting hold of guns. We have to do something about this. In Baltimore, as a white person, there's almost no chance of me being shot with a gun. We know the statistics here in Baltimore. We've got to have a legitimate dialogue. The only people that can change this sick gun culture would be Congress, and we have the best Congress money can buy, and obviously the NRA has bought Congress. I could say much more, but I want to let other people participate in this dialogue.
Max, I appreciate the call and your thoughts, as usual. And Furman, let me let you start.
Well, yeah, I agree that we do have a runaway gun culture in the society. But I would also point out that it has really escalated in the last 10 or so years. This is when we've seen the growth of these gun-friendly laws. We have seen the rise of campus carry laws across the country. We have seen the rise of open carry, stand your ground. These are all recent legal developments over the last 10 or so years. And as other participants in the conversation mentioned, you know, the number, I think it was when a caller pointed out, the number of gun sales surged with each of Obama's elections, and with every kind of, you know, shooting, there is a surge in the number of sales. I would like to point out, you know, that what's interesting about this discussion, I agree with Charlie and Dante, that guns are not the center of the issue when it comes to African-American communities and the various problems that they face. However, guns are a perfectly noxious ingredient, and it cannot hurt. It can only help to remove them. I would also like to point out that, as some of our, you know, participants have kind of indicated, there is a lot of racism and white extremism that is wrapped up in the contemporary gun rights movement. And to the extent that we deal a blow to the NRA, we deal a blow to that.
And Charlie Cobb, can you pick up on that point too? Because I think that there's a lot of credence to that point. I mean, the NRA is a very right wing, very racist, and that's who they are. Who want the right to carry in the street, who want to set zones up, stand your ground.
Yes, that's true. So how do you deal with that? The deal with that is to be organized enough to reduce, if not eliminate, their influence. You know, part of the reason the NRA is so powerful is that Black and brown communities are so weak politically. And so, again, we're back, and I keep stressing this point.
Mm-hmm.
We're back to the organizing question, organizing for power, organizing for influence, and we actually have the numbers, but we don't use them effectively, and we don't have a leadership. Let me put it this way. You know, the Black middle class has dramatically expanded since the late 1960s. The poor in the Black community have gotten poorer. And the Black middle class actually pays very little attention to the Black poor, except when the Black poor embarrasses them. Question. How do you organize? I estimate that 25% of the Black community to take control of their communities. I don't think you can solve this problem with new gun laws or new legislation. You solve this problem by figuring out how to empower people. Without that, you'll get nowhere, in my view.
Let me do this, since we have about eight or nine minutes left in this conversation. We have three callers here, a number calling in, but these three at least. Try to get quick thoughts from them and come back to our guests with some final thoughts on where we all are. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Owusu in Louisiana. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning
Welcome.
To all.
Welcome.
It seems to me that the discussion on guns has evolved. Today, most of the discussion revolves around black-on-black crime and then the police use of guns. But I wanted to hear a little more from your panelists in terms of the connection with guns and the civil rights and freedom rights movement, particularly with the Digits for Defense, Robert Williams, and the Panther Party. I'll hang up and listen off air.
Thank so thanks so much. That's a very long discussion, but I will ask Charlie to comment on that because they're all very...
Very, very briefly, an important part of the Southern civil rights movement was the willingness in black communities for people to defend themselves. There would have been a lot more killing in the South if people hadn't used their weapons, and sometimes they upgraded their weapons once the movement came into town or the county. And that's what kept us, I was a civil rights worker, alive. The Deacons in Louisiana, where this caller is from, was maybe the most organized of these self-defense groups. Usually self-defense in the South involved an individual or a community, but not highly organized the way the Deacons for Defense and Justice were. Robert Williams reflects, in Monroe, North Carolina, reflects the beginning of that, because key to this willingness to defend oneself with weapons was the return of World War II veterans. If you look at that Monroe, North Carolina group that Robert Williams led,
right,
that NCP chapter, it was largely composed of World War II veterans. If you look in most of these communities, that were the individuals who took the lead in mounting self-defense, they were World War II veterans. So there is a track record of being able to defend yourself with weapons against terrorists.
Let me just get a couple quick, one quick call in here, let you all kind of final out, I mean, give some final thoughts here. We did have someone tweeting in saying guns are used to self-defense 800,000, 2.5 million times a year. But that's actually, let me just say that very quick, Edward, it's not true. We don't know if that's true or not. That was a study done by the NRA and the right wing, but was never vetted nor proven. It's just it's a talking point for the right wing. I just want to point that out. 410-319-8888, whether you agree with having guns or not. I just want to make sure that that is unreal. 410-319-8888. A very quick thought from Nick in Crofton.
Hey, Mark, great discussion as
Thank
always.
You.
I just want to say real quick, you know, that one gentleman you have on your panel has a title, I think, that says enough of this nonviolent stuff. I mean, everybody on, it's callers and panelists, even the person that wrote that book, has some pretty good points about why this is. But the solution of putting more guns into this, into that, this doesn't make any sense. Plus the fact on that book, I know what Dr. King would think about enough of this nonviolence stuff, as he puts it. And one more quick point, Mark. You always do a good job of keeping this discussion tight to this. Now we're talking about gun violence. I think everybody's made great points about widening this out to the fact that, you know, Reagan's war on drugs, the fact that you pretty much decentralized and take the jobs out of this economy and allow these corporations to sell overseas, that a city like Baltimore comes deindustrialized. The fact that you pack people into these ghettos and barrios, I mean, that can't be withstood, absolutely, that fact. But no, I know you got other calls, but yeah, no question about it. Putting more guns into a situation like that sounds like a prescription for death. Thanks, Mark.
Let me go around with my panel here, but I know just Charlie Cobb can always speak for himself, doesn't need anybody to speak for him, but the book is called The Nonviolent Self Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible. It doesn't talk about, the book actually, when you read the book, said the power of the nonviolent tactic was particularly important to do in the South but backing up that were the farmers and everybody else who were armed, who saved lives of many of us at different times in that struggle. So that's, I think, in a nutshell. So let me just say that. But let's go around the room here very fast and have some closing thoughts from you all. If you have time, we'll get another caller in, okay? So don't hang up yet. We'll try to get to you. But Dante, let me start with you. Dante Barry.
So I think the last quote that you just referenced from Charlie's book, I think is really important to note, right, when you think about the 1960s civil rights movement, right? Nonviolence was also a tactic as much as it was a philosophy, just as much as armed resistance was a tactic, especially as much was a effort to keep communities safe. So I think when we think about this in terms of today in relationship to guns and feeling safe, right, this is the dire need and urgency that Black communities need to be organizing. And it's why this movement for Black lives is so critical in revitalizing the Black left of the progressive movement, is that Black communities are in dire need to protect themselves and make themselves feel safe, but not only just to feel safe and survive, but to also thrive. Right, Black communities have been in this existence of just trying to survive, whether it's through a police killing or through a racist vigilante killing or violence within our own communities. This is also about how do we survive and thrive and how do we keep ourselves safe.
Let me go to Affirmative Brabander, and then we'll close up
sure.
with Charlie Cobb.
I would just say, you know, Charlie's point discussing the civil rights movement and the significance that guns played in protecting the nonviolent protesters, I think that is the kind of scenario where it makes sense. I can totally understand that guns were necessary because the protesters and the African Americans in the South were dealing with white terrorism. But I would ask this question now in 2015, you know, are we a civil society? Do we hope to be a civil society? The extent that we hope to be a civil society, guns cannot be part of that equation. The examples that Charlie is giving of the South that time, clearly that was not a civil society. African Americans were fearing for their lives, and that is a situation we must move beyond and transcend.
A very quick final thought from Charlie Cobb before we have to really break for the end of the show.
It's important to understand. I'm really just talking. My primary concern is the Black community.
Right.
I like to put something else in the mix, which we don't have a lot of any time to talk about. I think it would be worthwhile seeing what would happen in the most gang-ridden, violence-ridden parts of the inner city if you tried to organize around nonviolence. Could you do that? What would be the language that you would use? Would it be effective? Do you think it could be effective? I mean, the way to stop, I'm concerned about the number of deaths in Baltimore of Black people inside the Black community. Now, if you wanted to inject into the work in Baltimore the idea of ending violence, could you organize around nonviolence?
And that's a question I think worth really exploring in depth. And I've been talking to folks actually in Chicago who are trying to find the members of the gangs who met with King in 66. I'm really interested in that in terms of where we are today in the 21st century. First of all, I want to thank Charlie Cobb Jr., author of The Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible. Charlie, thanks so much for being with us once again. It's great to have you on the air.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. Dante Barry, Executive Director of A Million Hoodies for Justice, March for Justice. Dante, great to have you with us. Looking forward to having you back. More.
Thanks so much.
And Dr. Furman Brabander, Do Guns Make Us Free? Democracy and Armed Society, Professor of Philosophy. And Micah, good to have you here
thank
as well.
You.
Thank you. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineers, Andrea Melton. Our interns are Sienna Greaves, Manifa Wilson, and Calvin Perry. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. Send me your thoughts about today's show to talk@steinershow.org. And to podcast The Mark Steiner Show, share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org, or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.